VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome to the Game Podcast. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and this week I'm joined by Patty Barkley, Tom Dart, and Stuart Robson. Guess what? Nobody down a crummy phone line. They're all right here in the studio. We'll be looking at Arsenal as Bolton denied the Gunners a comeback with a late and emotional winner from Tamer Cohen, which effectively ends the title challenge. And also we'll be looking at leaders Manchester United as another late Chicharito goal seals three more valuable points. We'll have our usual favorites, like quick hits. And in our debate, we're discussing the relationship between the media, the players, the fans, and increasingly, Justice Eadie. So please stick with us for the next 35 minutes or so. We start up north, where Bolton defeat Arsenal 2-1. I think, just get this out of the way, title challenge over. Anybody disagree?
Nope.
All righty. Sorry, Gooners. It was one of those games where I don't think Arsenal were that poor. Ollie Kay wrote something that said, this defeat conformed to the stereotype of Arsenal this season. You know, in other words, a team that has the bulk of the possession, the bulk of the chances, but they don't actually win. Stuart, did Arsenal deserve to win the game?
No, they didn't, because they conceded two set plays. They've conceded set plays a lot of times over the last three or four seasons. They didn't take their chances, and they made defensive errors. And there's two sides to a football game. You have to be good in an attacking sense. You also have to be a good defensive side as well. And at the moment, Arsenal never, or the last six, seven, 8 weeks, haven't got the balance right between defensive play and attacking play. When they've defended well, they haven't attacked well enough. They haven't played at high enough tempo. When they've attacked well, which they did against Bolton, they had a lot of possession. They created chances. Van Persie was excellent. Fabregas picked one or two passes. Wilshere was brilliant in the first half, but they didn't defend well enough, and Sturridge kept on turning with the ball and going past people. Kevin Davies won balls in the air, and they didn't defend set plays. You don't deserve to win anything if you don't work hard enough at your set plays and your defensive game plan.
Tom, as simple as that, you were there. Do you agree with everything Stuart says?
Yes, Stuart's completely right.
But on the set play thing, I mean, just take that, Tom. On the first goal, Kale's header, I was wondering if Nasri's standing there just inside the post. You know, it's a strong header, but Nasri's a professional footballer. Why can't he just clear it away?
Well, he did. He did get a decent contact with it, but unfortunately for him, Sturridge was there to knock it in. The bigger problem was 2 seconds, 1 second earlier when Cahill rises to head the corner, and it's Clichy, who's short, who's challenging him rather than one of the taller centre-backs. So Cahill is always going to beat Clichy in the air.
Song was marking Cahill further back. Cahill makes his run. Song wasn't aware of it. Song gets caught behind two or three Arsenal players, and Clichy's in a zone, near what they call a sort of a near post zone, and he's never going to beat Cahill in the air. So Song was the player at fault to start with, that he didn't track the runner and didn't get in a good starting position of Cahill.
Yeah, the only point about this match that I really think shouldn't be lost is what Bolton Wanderers did. I mean, let's not forget, the last time we saw them was getting absolutely taken apart in the FA Cup semi final, and you sort of wondered then, has this sort of one of the teams of the season, really, and one of the managers of the season in Owen Coyle, are they going to go on their holidays now and basically feel sorry for themselves a bit? and fall into, you know, the middle of the table? The answer was no. And I think that was a very, very significant result, and very much in keeping with this season, in which the sort of defeatism that was threatening to infect the league has been banished. And I think for that reason, it's been a jolly good season.
I'm sort of in two minds about it, because you want to give credit for bouncing back. But by the same token, Coyle got everything, but I mean everything wrong. We talked about it before against Stoke. Stoke absolutely wiped the floor with him. Mm. He got his tactics wrong. Obviously, you know, he had some personnel missing, but, you know, he could have lost that game 10-0. Mm-hmm. Do you learn from it? Do you sometimes learn more from abject failure than from success?
Well, sometimes you pick the side which you think is right. It doesn't go right for you. Again, against Arsenal, yes, they played Elmander in midfield. When I saw the lineup with Elmander and Mwamba in midfield against Arsenal's three, I thought Arsenal would murder them in that area. And they did to a certain degree, but he got other players to work hard. He got Kevin Davis to come back to almost be a third midfield player when Arsenal had the ball. Mm. And the difference between the two teams, the Bolton side that played against Stoke and the Bolton side that played yesterday, they had a cut and thrust up front with Sturridge, who was absolutely outstanding. Right. For a lot of the game.
We mentioned that about Sturridge. Bolton, of course, won a penalty, which Kevin Davis missed. But it seemed pretty clear to me Giroud on Sturridge looked like a dive. Does this mean that, well, A, does anybody disagree? And B, does this mean we can finally put this whole thing to rest about foreign players, young English players diving, and, you know, what's tolerated, what's not tolerated? Oh, I mean, you were there, Tom. Like, did you see the Bolton fans rise up and say, "No, Sturridge, in the Corinthian spirit that drives us Lancastrians, you know, we demand that you not take the penalty." Was that why Kevin Davis missed it? Because he was ashamed by Sturridge's diving under Giroud's challenge, and I use that word very loosely?
I suspect probably not. Bolton fans are certainly rising, and they were kind of cheering happily and ecstatically, and it was just one of these things where the slightest contact in the box is given as a penalty, and the referees need to be a bit smarter and realise that just because a defender has his hand on a forward, it doesn't necessarily mean that he's pulling him down. He's just getting in close proximity to him, and Sturridge dived really effectively, and the referee was behind, so perhaps it looked worse than it was from that angle, but it was certainly didn't do Sturridge a lot of credit, although equally Giroud's defending was poor to get him in that position, and the fact that Sturridge got behind him to give him the opportunity to do that.
Did it look like a dive to you from in the press box in real time?
Yes.
Paddy, it's interesting because we talked about the way Tom touched upon that, the way Giroud defended. And in your column in the game today, you kind of raise this issue. You call it sort of grappling.
Yes.
And the fact that you underscore the point that defenders so often use their hands against opposing forwards.
Hands and arms, you know, often... in most tackles now, you just need to look in the newspapers. When you see a picture of a tackle, the player almost invariably is holding the player who's being tackled. So that, I mean, the classic case, I went back to look at the way, while writing this column, I went back to look at the Agbon Lahore incident in the league, the Carling Cup final last season, where Vidic once again, as usual, as happens in virtually every game, deserves to be sent off and isn't. The photograph of that I consulted showed that Vidic, as well as bringing Agbon Lahore down, was pulling his shirt at the same time. And I think this is... I cannot understand why referees allow players to manhandle other players in, outside the box, all over the pitch. So much so now that I imagine, and Stuart will correct me if I'm wrong, that now coaches teach players how to use their upper body, their arms, and their hands in defending. And I find it absolutely ugly and indefensible.
Moving on to Old Trafford, Manchester United and Everton. This was a game where... you could say United took one huge step closer to winning it. And it's interesting. What surprised me a little bit was they played, I thought, quite an understrength team, United did. I mean, we saw Darren Gibson, you know, Johnny Evans, who has had a poor season this year, you know, Evra on the bench. And I got to myself thinking, like, were they resting players ahead of, with all due respect, Schalke? And also, did they know that Everton were going to be you know, we're also going to be so under strength and missing so many players. Was that the logic? And figure we don't need our big guns. Mm-hmm. Patty, I want to start with you. Were you surprised when you saw the starting lineup?
No, not at all. The Schalke away match, which will, I mean, could well define, it could well be won in the away match, you know, if Schalke are dreaming of 1-0. But if Manchester United must score out there to be, you know, to be pretty sure of going through, and I think it's a vital game. Everyone's saying it's going to be a walkover, and it should be, but Manchester United can't afford to think that way. They could, however, have just about afforded to have dropped 2 points to Everton.
Why?
Because
given the way results went, they've got Arsenal and Chelsea next.
Yeah.
I mean, they lose those two games.
I think they thought that was the lesser risk. And also, what you have to bear in mind is that Sir Alex Ferguson has become the first manager. They always used to say of managers, the problem with this guy is he doesn't know his best team. Sir Alex Ferguson hasn't known his best team for 5 years. He's redefined, completely changed the nature of football management in the age of rotation. And so it's very difficult to know. I think the presence of Darren Gibson is always a sign, but it's very difficult otherwise to know what is, you know, what he's doing. Basically, he has a team of 22 players, and that's the way he runs Manchester United, and it's incredibly successful. Any other manager could try it and it wouldn't work. Somehow Ferguson is able to have a house style that survives wholesale changes, and this is just yet another instance.
Looking at that Everton lineup with Osman behind the striker and all those defensive players plus Bielalatinov in midfield, I thought this is going to be a walkover even with the understrength United, but Everton certainly hung in there and even had quite a strong penalty claim in the second half, Rio Ferdinand on Anichibi. Stuart, how did you see it?
Yes, there was contact. Yes, Anichibi went to ground very easily. It could be given one way or the other. And when it's at Manchester United and when it's at Old Trafford, usually United get the benefit of the doubt. Did Everton play well? Yes, they are. They're a team in form at the moment. They've been playing well. They packed their midfield. They tried to get Beckford going in behind, which he did for Leeds against Manchester United. And they caused one or two problems. And I thought they worked really hard at their game plan. Everton, they stopped Manchester United playing in midfield. They cut out the balls into the wide areas where Nani and Valencia were playing. And Everton, I think when they play really well and when they work hard, they are a good football side.
Paddy, on the issue of Chicharito Hernandez, what I find fascinating is this is a guy who a little more than 2 years ago was ready to quit football altogether. Mm-hmm. You know, he was a Chivas, he was fourth choice striker. Yes. He sort of spent the previous 2 years constantly on loan to the lower divisions, going back and forth. I think he felt some weight from the fact that his grandfather and his father, of course, both represented Mexico in World Cups. And then he comes here and I think pretty much, you know, fits in seamlessly.
Yeah.
You know, does the hard running. But he basically does what, you know, Michael Owen used to do a decade ago.
Yeah.
Plus more things that maybe Owen didn't do.
Yes.
And, you know, you look at the legacy of Mexican players coming to the Premier League, which there isn't many. In fact, Mexican players in Europe, apart from Hugo Sanchez and Rafa Márquez. Surely he must be one of the signings of the season, if not the signing of the season.
I think he would be the signing of the season ahead of Rafael van der Vaart and so on. I think he's been a wonderful signing. You get very much a sense that he's a Manchester United player with all that entails in terms of work rate, modesty, self-effacement and the winning mentality. It truly has been an extraordinary first season. I watched the Community Shield, and I mean, you could just see that this was something special. He seems a nice lad. He's got a great attitude to the game, and he's just going to get better and better and better and better. The header against Everton was, I mean, no towering centre forward in the history of the game has put a header away better than that. I mean, it's just everything about him.
Do I see need to send the ghost of Nat Lofthouse?
Nat Lofthouse wouldn't have done any better than that, would he? I mean, it was the way he smacked it down, almost like putting a basketball away. I mean, it really was great technique, and I just think everything about him, his movement, his team play. I mean, he and Rooney can be one of the greatest forward partnerships in the world for five more years.
Stuart, I want to get your input on this, because obviously you've got, you know, you've not just been a player and a player who, you know, got a lot of attention as a very when you were very young, but also a coach. And when I look at this, the fact that, you know, less than 2.5 years ago he was ready to give up on football altogether, when you see this development, in your experience, is this generally something that wasn't there before and that he suddenly improved? Was it something that was there but maybe wasn't perfectly teased out?
I think probably teams weren't playing to his strength, because when I watch him play, he can run in behind. He's got great pace. As Paddy said, he's good in the air, excellent in the air when balls come into the box. He sees danger. He sees the opportunity to get into the box. There's one area of his game that needs vast improvement, and that's with his back to goal. The ball goes up to him quite often. It bounces off him and he doesn't control it properly, or makes the wrong decision whether to turn or lay the ball back first time. When he was playing in Mexico, they probably played into feet all the time, and he didn't show the same attributes as he's now showing for Manchester United, which is running behind. And Paddy's quite right. With Wayne Rooney playing as a much deeper centre forward and Chicharito playing as the main player who tries to get in behind, it's a great combination. But I think that's the reason why he didn't do quite so well in Mexico, because they weren't playing to his attributes. They were playing into his feet, which he's not quite so good at the moment.
Rooney, perhaps not, you know, back to goal, maybe not his strength either. Could that be a problem in terms of them as a potential partnership? Will there always need to be sort of a third element to it, whether off the bench or... we know Sir Alex is going to rotate, but...
Well, I think what Wayne Rooney, I think he is quite good with his back to goal. Not in terms of, he doesn't play in straight lines. He'll come off and get himself turned on an angle. He'll let the ball run across his body, and then he's looking forward to play that next pass. And what Rooney, the best thing about Wayne Rooney, and I played with Charlie Nicholas, who everybody would talk, when he came down from Scotland, he was a dribbler and a great goal scorer. He lacked pace, but his best attribute was actually his passing. When he played deeper, when he couldn't run past people, he played deeper and started hitting crossfield balls. He started poking balls between centre-halves. And that's exactly what Wayne Rooney's doing at the moment. And Wayne Rooney's a far better player than Charlie Nicholas was.
Yeah, Wayne Rooney, I love Wayne Rooney off the front. I mean, people said he can play as a centre-forward. But, I mean, you know, that really is not the way he wants to play. He wants that area off. That's why even playing in a three behind a centre-forward suited him. Even when he was on the left, suits him better. Than playing as a number nine. And so that's why, you know, for all the reasons, I think this is the most exciting combination. And what's more, it's so beautiful to watch unselfish football. They're both unselfish footballers. And it's you know, everything that's right about football, these two as a partnership epitomise, in my opinion.
Tom, a final word here on this, and you get to talk about Wayne Rooney. What it needs to happen between now and... you know, let's say in the next 30 days, for Wayne Rooney to remember 2010-11 as a good year?
Let's say scoring the winner in the Champions League final at Wembley. I think that would crown a dramatic renaissance in the second half of the season. But pretty much from January, he's turned his form around, and the goals are now flowing as well. And he's finding a better balance between playing this almost attacking midfielder role, but also getting in the box to score, not approaching the frequency of last season, but he is now finding a better balance, not dropping quite so deep. He is getting in dangerous areas as well as being a creator, and if he were to perform really well against Schalke and then in the final of the Champions League, I think he could say that the second half of his season will have made up in large part for the dismal first.
And Paddy, actually, you get the last word on this, because it's a fellow member of the Scott fraternity.
Yes.
If you're Davy Moyes,
yeah,
and you look at where you're likely to finish this season,
yes,
are you going to be happy, and are you going to maybe start really getting itchy feet once and for all, and
I think it's
time to move on?
I think it's time for David Moyes to be doing his job in the Champions League rather than hoping to get in the Europa League, and wondering why the team don't start the season better. It's a strange pattern that it's got into at Everton. It's a bit reminiscent of Charlton Athletic under Kerbishley. The season always went in distinct phases. almost as if they were dictated by the moon rather than the training schedules. So I think it's time to go. And if he can't get into the Champions League in England, then he should go to somewhere like Germany. If he can get a job there and ply his trade in the Champions League, I think he's such a good learner, Moyes, that he would be an ideal immigrant. You know, and could, you know, perhaps even have more success, or have success in the way that Steve McLaren did in Holland.
If you're listening, Davey, remember to credit Paddy when you win the Greek League. All right, in our debate this week, we're kind of going across the board in sort of the relationships between the different stakeholders, I guess, you talk about in the game, obviously, the players and managers, the fans, the media. Last week saw a situation where Cesc Fabregas gave an interview to a Spanish magazine, Don Balón. Mm. I personally don't think that he said anything that Wenger himself hasn't said, except possibly one thing, which is that there's a trade-off between, you know, developing and
as you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Playing pretty football and success. Yes, yes. Apart from that, every single thing Fabregas said is not just true, in my opinion, but it's stuff that Wenger has also said.
Yes.
Now, the media, as often happens, took those quotes, ran them here. I think most reported honestly, but there was an issue with the headlines. It was interpreted as, you know, Cesc attacking Wenger, and that's what incensed Arsene Wenger afterwards. Now, what I want to throw out there, this issue of the headline, because Michael Owen touched upon it as well. Michael Owen, speaking on Twitter, where he says most of the time it's not his quotes. You know, he's happy to speak to the media, but he gets wary because they get turned into big sensationalized headlines, or even in the broadsheets. It's not just a tabloid issue. Tom, in your experience, has that been... Is that the case? I mean, did you see like a big headline like, you know, and I'll mention him because he's a mate and he's no longer here, you know, Di Canio puts the boot into Harry Redknapp. And then you read the piece and it's nothing like that.
Yeah, this happens all the time in
every paper. So it's the fault of those nameless, faceless sub-editors, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's never the fault of the writer.
Exactly.
Well, the truth is that a headline is meant to grab your attention and draw you in and be dramatic and interesting and exciting, and the people who write the headlines in newspapers are not the same people who are writing the article, who are meeting the player or the manager. There is a bit of a disconnect there. Very often now you get clubs who want copy approval, such as Arsenal, who seek to control every part of the process. And you could make the argument that that is excessive paranoia and unreasonable, or you could make the argument that they are just protecting their players' interest, because you do get situations where sometimes players are misrepresented, and it's not always in the article, it's in the headline. Do people always read the article, or do they just stop at the headline and draw their own conclusions from that?
Paddy, on the issue of copy approval, this is one of the things that upset Arsenal, because according to them, they said that, you know, Don Balón had agreed that they would then send Cesc quotes to Arsenal's press office, who would then go over them and approve them and so on.
Yes.
I feel very strongly about copy approval. I don't give copy approval to anybody. I'd rather not speak to somebody. I may send the quotes to them just to see so that they know what's out there.
Yeah.
But I would never change a quote because somebody, you know, you either trust me, talk to me, or you don't.
Yes.
Does the media go too far with copy approval?
I think it's a terribly difficult issue because I can see both sides of it. It's partly to do with the way newspapers are configured now. A statement is described as news. Now, if Arsene Wenger were to punch Cesc Fabregas, to me that's news. If Arsene Wenger were to say, I think Cesc Fabregas is a very good player, that to me isn't news. You know, just sort of opinion becomes news. And I think that in order to make it punchy and newsy, it has to be twisted. A lie has to be told. And that for that reason, on balance, if I were a head of communications of Arsenal Football Club, or indeed any other football club, I would ask for, and I hate to say this, I really hate to say this, because I'm with you emotionally all the way along the line in what you said before, but I would ask for copy, headline and presentational approval on every single word that was issued from my club.
If I ever run a newspaper and you ever run a football club and you come to me to say that, you know what I'm going to do?
Yeah, you've been working with me.
I'm going to run blank space where your results are. And if I ever run a picture of one of your players, I'm going to black out his face and draw a funny mustache on there. And most of all, just erase all the sponsors' names.
You know, the one thing that really annoys me about football clubs is the way that they do try and control everything that's written about the club and everything that's written about their players. Because what they're doing, they're overprotecting the players, and the players haven't got any idea how to talk to the media now. They're hopeless.
It's funny. I mean, it's the worst both ways. I recently saw an interview Paul Scholes gave with MUTV, and it was interesting because you can tell, you know, for those who don't know, Paul Scholes very, very rarely speaks to the media. And after that interview, I could see why. It was in between the first and second legs of the Champions League when they'd beaten Chelsea, and he goes out and he says, oh, Chelsea were utter rubbish in the first leg, you know, we could have beaten them by 3 or 4 goals. And, you know, when we play Schalke in the next round, I think it's going to be very easy. We'll get through the final. I mean, it was all stuff like that, which was wonderfully refreshing and honest. But and that's the flip side of it. You know, you could tell why this guy isn't let loose or probably doesn't want to speak to the media, because he would get in trouble every single day. But or not get in trouble, but have his quotes sensationalized and so on. But I want to throw out a different model to any football club listening out there. I mean, I have a dream. I see a shining city on a hill where a football club tells its players, right, you talk to whoever you want, whenever you want. If you say something that the club are not happy with, we will fine you because we have a right to do it because it's in your contract. Beyond that, no copy approval, responsibility is all yours. And I think if you were to do that, then I think the players would learn pretty quickly who to talk to, who not to talk to, on what terms, and put the responsibility on the players. I've met Cesc Fabregas. I've spent time with him. He is more intelligent than 99.9% of people in the media, people at football clubs or other footballers. Mm-hmm. He can handle the situation. And I think but the problem is when you start treating footballers like children, this is where you run into them. Give them responsibility.
And what I don't understand is that all these press officers, they want to control everything the player says, but they never give any advice to the manager. I've seen some of Arsene Wenger's press conferences where all the things that have come from his mouth have inflamed the situation. Yes. He said all the wrong things. Yeah. Why doesn't the press officer there say these are going to be the questions that are going to be thrown at and give him some advice?
We newspaper folks used to say that, you know, when we complain to football clubs about, you know, not getting access to the manager or to the players, we would talk about, oh, but, you know, you're our conduit to speak to the fans and you're denying it to the fans. In an age of official club websites and official club television stations, do the fans still really need us to get post-match quotes from players? Is there, I mean, when you go up to, you know, a mix zone to talk to a player after a match, do you feel as if you're working for the fans? Do you feel as if you're working, you know, for yourself to help uncover the truth? Do you feel like you're doing it because it's what we do?
I think newspapers are still providing a valuable service because we are independent and we should be neutral and we should be objective. Yeah. If you just let the clubs become media organisations, which is what they're trying to do, to be honest, because... Mm-hmm. they can manipulate the image to suit them. They can produce whitewashed, bland, corporate impressions of players, and they can make money of it out of it by having their own TV stations and their own internet sites. So you are getting an increasing situation where clubs are encroaching on the territory of newspapers, but still allowing newspapers access. So you have a real tension there. You can still rely on the press, despite its flaws. We may not be perfect, but we are going to give a more objective and reasoned analysis of a game, by and large, than you would get on a club website.
But can I say, sorry, just to pick up on Tom, you're talking about analysis there, and I agree with that. And in fact, in the very early days of sports writing, at least in America, the belief was that if you covered a sport, you shouldn't have any contact with the manager or the players, because it would somehow influence you. Yeah. So in terms of analysis, a bit like Stuart said earlier, you can sit there in the press box, watch the game, and analyze what happens.
Yes.
But I'm talking about the needing to speak to these people, the reporting side of it. Do you feel that it's, and especially the quote gathering side of it? Because the problem is the people who are the better talkers are often the more anodyne ones.
It's difficult. The players can't win. If they say something boring, it will end up getting blown out of proportion because of the need to fill space and newspapers' desperate desire to maintain their circulations in a declining market. Newspapers are just shouting ever louder. But the trouble is, if the player says something genuinely interesting and worthwhile, then that gets blown out of proportion as well because everyone's so shocked and taken aback by an outbreak of honesty in a general sea of blandness that gets exaggerated, and you get players ending up being in trouble with the authorities and with the clubs. So the players can't really win whatever they do.
Yeah.
And we've got Twitter now, which is great. It's really refreshing to see players talking directly to the fans, to the media, without a conduit, without a medium, which is great. But then in the end up, if they're too honest, they end up getting fined by the FA, or they end up getting in the newspapers just the same same sensationalism. So it is difficult for the players, and we are in a celebrity culture now in sports journalism where, as Paddy says, a quote by a famous person has become news, disproportionately important.
The problem is when it's taken out of context. The kind of journalism I like and I've always liked reading and I've tried to practice, it's very, very difficult now, is always contains, the article would always contain an indiscretion, but it would be, if it arose naturally in the 17th paragraph, it would remain there. The difficulty now is that, and when I say now, I mean for the last 15 years, has been that the nugget is always taken out of context,
and they say, and put it at the top,
that's
of the
got to go at the top, and of course that ruins it, because if you take something out of the context, you inevitably distort it, and that's what journalism, I'm afraid, today is all about. Although I do take Tom's point about why we are a necessary evil is because of the independence. The funny thing is, all you need to do if you doubt that is watch MUTV.
Yeah, but what I would say,
which makes Pravda look like a broad church.
But my big problem with all sorts of journalism, co-commentator, whatever it may be, punditry. Mm. Is not all of it is unbiased.
Yeah.
Because reporters get in with certain people.
Yeah. And I've made mistakes in discussing managers who I like.
And pundits, I know pundits that are friendly, so they will never criticise players that they're friendly with, but they'll criticise his mate next door because they're never going to see him again.
Yeah.
And that's what's wrong. Biased opinion.
Final point on this, and this is one of my favourite subjects, but Tom, I'm guessing you're the youngest one here. Will newspapers be around for your children to read when they're in their 20s?
Yes, but I think there'll be their role will have changed, and there'll be more analysis and intelligent comment than they are now. There'll be less breaking stories. Breaking stories will be the province of instant websites and whatever format we read by this time, whereas whether there'll still be a place for intelligent voices, reasoned voices, and considered voices, the real elite journalists will still have their place, despite the increasing number of amateur, unpaid, you know, journalists. So I think they will be, but they'll be vastly changed and vastly restricted.
The Future, presented by Tom Dart. And now, because the Easter Bunny has come and gone, it's time for some quick hits. Fernando Torres finally scores for Chelsea in their 3-0 win over West Ham. Paddy, you knew this was going to happen at some point, right? Mm-hmm. And will this cue Chelsea's dramatic comeback to win the Premier League?
Not this season.
The Barclays Premier League.
Not this season, but maybe next. I think that if they bite the bullet and let Drogba go this summer while there's still some value in him, I think they might get the best part of $10 million, which, you know, will help their financial fair play computations. I think there are signs that Torres can be the centre forward of a very good championship challenging team next season.
Well, possibly even with Ancelotti still around.
Hope so.
Liverpool pummel Birmingham 5-0 and Joe Cole gets on the score sheet. But there's plenty of rumours that he'll be on his way in the summer. Stuart, if you were Joe Cole's dad, or better yet, his agent, what sort of club would you steer him towards? Name names. This is fantasy role play.
He's got to play at a club where he's going to be get in the team every week. So it could be a championship club at the moment. But no, I would say a team maybe like Birmingham. If they stay up, a team like Bolton, who I think Owen Cole could probably get the best out of him. So they're the sort of sides that I think that Joe Cole has to go. He can't play in the big top four clubs anymore because he's not quite consistent enough and he wouldn't get enough games. He needs to play week in, week out to get his career back on track.
Joey Cole, are you listening? Tottenham are held by West Brom 2-2, but Terry Redknapp feels slighted, arguing that Spurs belong in the top four. Tom, is he right? And will they be there at the end of the season?
He is right. They're certainly worthy of the top four, but I don't think they will quite make it. If you look at the weekend's fixtures, Spurs away to Chelsea, Manchester City at home to West Ham, you've got to feel the gap is only going to increase. It is going to be a painful thing for Spurs to take if they're not going back to the Europa League after doing so well in the Champions League. But it's just going to be a real shame because they prove they are good enough, but it's not going to happen.
And they have the manager of the year too, don't they? Some people's anyway. The Old Firm derby ends in a scoreless draw, all but sealing the title for Celtic, but also marked the end of a horrible week, which saw a package containing a bomb sent to Celtic boss Neil Lennon. Paddy, this is an age-old issue, but was it ever this bad? And how is Scottish football going to get out of this?
Scottish society, I would say. I mean, it was ever this bad. It used to be worse, believe it or not. The sectarianism was more naked and the violence more prevalent. There were murders, plenty of them. That's not to make light of the bombs sent to Celtic boss Neil Lennon and others. And I think that the police and Scottish society, there are signs that Scottish society are going to rise up against this virulent minority of of Protestant fundamentalists, you might call them. And they've just have got to be driven out by the rest of society. And then things can actually get, and things, believe it or not, are better than they used to be.
Maybe some hope ahead. Darren Bent scores again, as I read in the Times today. It's his 7th in 12. Stuart, with hindsight, can we definitely say he's been worth the transfer fee?
Yes, he has. I mean, Darren Bent, when he was at Ipswich as a young player, he had all the attributes to be a top-class player, and he was messed up by going to Charlton, because Charlton played him as a lone striker, and they just wanted him to chase balls in the corner week in, week out, and he got absolutely shed. So the other parts of his game, his link-up play, his technical ability, started to get worse. I think he's a good player. He'll score goals for Aston Villa, and if Aston Villa can get the best out of him in the other parts of the game, he can be a top player.
Blackpool are held 1-1 by Newcastle, but Ian Holloway isn't happy with the officiating. He said that maybe Blackpool were just too small a club to get certain decisions. Tom, is he on to something?
Roberto Martinez, Wigan manager, said something similar a couple of weeks ago, but I'm getting a bit fed up of managers who imply this and pussyfoot around the issue. If you think a referee is biased, say the word bias. Say he's a cheat. What is Holloway really saying here? Is he effectively saying that the referee's cheating and wants Blackpool not to win the game? That seems to be the logical conclusion of these comments, but in the end, managers just say, oh, we don't get the decisions, we're a small club. Say what you really mean. If you really think there's some bias, whether unconscious or conscious, then we have to hear that, and it has to be investigated properly. Not,
but if you do that, Tom, then you'll just be fined. And then when you move to a big club, people will call you a hypocrite when you benefit from the decisions, right?
I guess so. I guess so. And there may be some mileage in the idea that referees, like ordinary people, I suppose, would be unconsciously biased towards famous people and impressed by them. And if you know someone better, then that will affect your behaviour towards them. But I don't think it's fair. And frankly, I don't see any evidence from that in the games that I've watched.
Stirring words from Tom Dart, and a hard act for you to follow, Gab, because now we're going to turn the tables and you have to answer a question. The Champions League semi-finals are this week. There's already talk about referee appointments. How can that be?
Because there's already controversy, Paddy. UEFA took some unusual choices. For the Schalke Manchester United match, they selected a guy named Carballo, who's probably the third or fourth best Spanish referee, and he's got very little experience. Only 4 Champions League games in his entire career thus far, only 1 in the knockout round. And I guarantee you that should Schalke advance due to some controversial decisions, people will suggest, oh, look, a Spanish referee to favor the Spanish clubs in the other half of the draw by sending the weaker Schalke team, supposedly weaker, into the final. By the same token, the other one, they also kind of set themselves up again. Pedro Proença, he's a Portuguese referee. Barcelona don't like that because Mourinho is Portuguese and Pepe and Cristiano Ronaldo. By the same token, there's some Real Madrid fans who don't like it because this Pedro Proença, he sent off Mourinho twice back in 2003. So you really can't please everybody, but this time around, I do think UEFA set themselves up for, put it this way, they put themselves in a situation where with problems that could have been avoided. Yes, I'm really going to call this on myself. Sorry. It's a complex question. Paddy chose a complex question this week. We'll be back next week with another episode of The Game. In the meantime, you can go to www.thetimes.co.uk. You'll find your news, your gossip, your analysis. Also, our web chats. Mine's on Mondays. Ollie Case is on Wednesdays. And you can hear Paddy on
Tuesdays.
Well, you can't really hear him. You can actually sort of web chat virtually from him. And this week, I think you're going to be in a remote location. Is that right, Paddy?
I'm going to be in Essen preparing with Tom, I think, for the Schalke match. And I'll be in a state of extreme excitement.
Fantastic. Gelsenkirchen. There you go. It's Gelsenkirchen, Venice, Paris, the world's great cities. Also, don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter. I'm there. Paddy's there. Tom's there. Stuart, you're not on Twitter yet, but
no, not yet.
You'll catch a disease one day. We're going to be back next Monday as United travel to the Emirates and Chelsea take on a team called Tottenham Hotspur at Stamford Bridge. Thank you so much for your time. Catch up with us next week. Till then, toodle-y.
Listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.